Chapter 37. Ross found the whole Mackenzie family together in the Sandpiper. Ven had asked him to notify them of Frank Lay's death. They were friends, and another suicide will hit them badly. It'll bring back the details of their son's death. By the time Ross got there, it was late afternoon, and the cafe had been closed to the public. Inside, they were preparing for the evening's event. Posters on the wall advertised a play, a performance of Waiting for Godot by a small Cornish touring company. Ross had heard of Beckett but knew nothing about him, except that he was obscure. He was put off by anything that reminded him of school. When he pushed open the door, he walked into darkness. There were heavy blinds on all the windows. A loud woman's voice shouted at him from the gloom.
"Sorry, we're not open, not even for the bar."
It wasn't Janie, someone older. A loud, confident, superior woman's voice that rankled. Her mother, perhaps?
"It's DC Ross May. I need to talk to the Mackenzies."
Just as his eyes got used to the shadow inside, a spotlight was turned on and blinded him. He wondered if that was deliberate, and again he felt awkward.
"Sorry."
This time the apology did come from Janie. "We're just getting ready for this evening's play." The house lights came on and he saw that the cafe was being transformed. It built a low stage at one end of the room and rows of chairs faced it. The counter, which had served sandwiches and cream teas during the day, was now set up to provide wine and cocktails. Ross thought Mel might like it here. He should bring her here one evening, though not to see a piece of theatre they would probably both struggle to understand. Janie was wearing a black t-shirt with a Sandpiper logo and frayed jeans. Her parents were at the back of the room working on the lighting. Ross recognized Martha Mackenzie because his mother was a fan of her TV soap. She shouted out to him again, the voice slightly too loud, slightly patronizing.
"This is really not a good time, Constable, and we've told your colleague all that we know."
"I have some news."
Then he repeated with more authority.
"I need to talk to you."
The older couple moved from the back of the room. Janie pulled three of the chairs into a semicircle and they sat looking at him. Again, he felt a little daunted. Martha was wearing a silver tunic over her wide black trousers. Her makeup was dark and dramatic. Heavy black eyeliner and mascara with dark red lipstick. But still she seemed to glow, to pull his eyes towards her.
"Well," she demanded, "what do we need to know? Have you found the killer? Is that it?"
"I'm afraid there's been another death."
It wasn't how he'd planned to tell them. He'd put together some words driving from the farm. "I know Mr. Lay was a close friend and this will come as a shock."
"Who?"
This was Janie. She seemed horrified by the news. In the strange theatrical lights, her face seemed very pale, her eyes wide and large, like something from a cartoon, not real at all. None of this seemed quite real.
"Francis Lay."
"Not Frank!"
George Mackenzie's response seemed the most genuine.
"No."
"He was found on the common near to his garden this morning."
"How did he die?"
George demanded.
"Was he stabbed like Nigel and Wesley?"
"We won't confirm cause of death until after the post-mortem, but it seems that he committed suicide."
There was complete silence.
"He had everyone round for drinks the night before last," Janie said. "The Greaves and Eve and us. A kind of commemoration of three lives lost. That was what he said."
She paused.
"But perhaps it was his way of saying goodbye."
"How did he seem?"
Now Martha did speak.
"Bloody sad, as we all were. We were mourning three people close to us, and now it seems he was contemplating taking his own life too. And you ask how he was? Good God!"
She stood up, pushing back the chair so violently that it fell over.
"I'm going outside for a fag, and to look out for those actors."
She left, and the room seemed very quiet.
"Please forgive my wife," George said at last. "She's very upset."
Ross was thinking that this whole conversation could have come straight out of a play. Everyone's response seemed stilted and unnatural. George shifted in his seat.
"Look, we should be getting ready for the evening's performance. You don't think we should cancel? We've got a full house."
Ross thought for a moment.
"No," he said. "No need for that."
As he was leaving the bar, a battered minivan drew up outside, and half a dozen people climbed out. Martha was there, greeting them, hugging them as if they were all old friends. Ross presumed they were the actors. As he walked away, he heard her loud voice carrying down the street. "Come along in. We've had a bit of sad news today, so we're not quite as organised as usual. But of course, the show will go on." He thought she sounded desperate, as if she was trying too hard to convince the world that she was in control. At the evening briefing, they concentrated on the possibility that Lei had been a member of the Peace at Last Forum. "We need your friend to come up with that information," Ven said, as if it was Ross's fault that Steve hadn't yet provided the goods. Could Lei have been the killer? This was Jen. His suicide wasn't triggered by a very different kind of guilt? Superintendent Oldham has already suggested that theory. Ven's voice was bland, but they could all tell he didn't think much of it. "It would be very neat, of course, but really, I don't see it. What motive would Lei have for killing Nigel and Wesley?" He looked up at them sharply. "And I refuse to blacken a dead man's name without real cause." It was just the core group tonight. Ven had bought in pizza and they'd pushed a couple of desks together and sat around, pulling the slices apart with their fingers. No plates and no napkins, though the boss had found a roll of paper towel somewhere. If there'd been beer, it could have been a student party. "Could Lei have been provoked to kill himself?" Jen asked. "If he was a member of the suicide club?" "Something to consider." Ven carefully wiped his hands. "I presume the Greaves will inherit his estate." "According to Sarah Grieve, Lei didn't believe in inherited wealth," Jen said. Her mouth was full of pizza. Not a good look. Mel would never speak with her mouth full. "She wasn't very hopeful that their family would get anything. She thought it might all go to charity." A pause. "You might be interested to know that John Grieve claimed to be in Spennacott yesterday afternoon, boss." "Very interesting. A coincidence, do you think?" "He wasn't visiting the old folks' home, and he'd claimed he'd never heard of Paul Reed. He's interested in taking over a farm on the edge of the moor there. He'd hoped Francis might invest in the venture, because he'd bought most of the village already." Ross could see Ven considering that. "So, if anything, that family might actually lose out by Francis's dying." "I suppose." Jen hesitated, and Ross saw there was more to come. "John Grieve seemed very tense to me. Jumping between anger and depression. Moody. Sarah says he spends a lot of time on the computer." "You think he might belong to the suicide club?" Jen shrugged. "It's certainly worth checking out." "I visited Lauren Miller yesterday," Matthew said. "It seems probable that her rejection of Lei was the trigger to his suicide." A pause. "She'd learned a little about the suicide club from Nigel. She's technically competent and had found her way into the chat room. Apparently the moderator, the person who seems actively to be advocating suicide, calls themselves the Crow." Lauren couldn't get beyond the nickname, though. He looked up at Ross. "Could your friend Steve do that? It's really urgent that we have that information." Again, his voice was disapproving, as if Ross was the person causing the delay. "If anyone can, he'll be the one to do it. I'll call him as soon as we're done here." "How are the Mackenzies?" "I don't know," Ross said. "They're a weird kind of family. But maybe it was just shock. I couldn't take to the mother, Martha. She seems like a real drama queen." "Didn't you say that Francis had invested in their business?" Jen asked. "Could that be significant?" "According to George, it was a loan," Ven said. "Not an investment. And they paid it off after the first year. I'll make an appointment with the solicitor in the morning. We'll have more to go on then." He stood up. "Let's get home at a decent time. It'll be a busy day tomorrow. Jen, can you go and see Lucy Braddock? Show her some photos of Wesley's lady friends. Try to catch her at home rather than at the woodyard. She's moved into independent living and wanted to show it off. Ask if she remembers seeing any of them on Sunday afternoon. She thought Wesley might be waiting for someone and she might have seen him with his killer. I promised to call in, but I haven't squeezed in the time." Ven paused. "Ross, I'll leave the tech to you. Sit down with your mate until we can get an answer. I don't want anyone else to jump ahead of us in this queue. and I'll see the solicitor to find out just how much of a fortune Francis Lay had left, where it's going, and who might have a financial motive for killing him. Out in the car park, Ross called Mel. She answered immediately.
Hiya, love. How's it going?
She sounded tired, but it was the old Mel. He'd been letting his imagination run away with him.
There's been another killing, he said. Another death, at least. But we're all done now.
Okay, then. See you soon. And that was all it took. A few seconds' conversation and his heart was singing. It seemed to him that he could have been taking her for granted, that all they needed was some quality time together. He phoned Techie Steve, but there was no reply, and he left a message.
I'll be at yours tomorrow at 8. It's urgent. I'll bring breakfast.
He set off for home. Chapter 38. Eve only realized as she ate supper in her flat that she was alone in the big house. No Wesley and no Frank. Frank had never made any noise at all, but here in the attic the walls were thin, and she'd often been aware of Wesley's presence, his music, his women, the very occasional sound of a Hoover. She imagined herself as a pea rattling around in a huge drum surrounded by space. The Greaves were only across the yard in their cottage, but Eve didn't want to see them. She re-ran the conversation with Lauren. It had been strained and awkward at first. The two detectives had left them alone to talk. Lauren had sat, gripping a mug of tea that never reached her lips.
I loved your father very much, the first words spoken.
So did my mother. Eve's words had been cruel and hard. They'd seemed to echo around the empty space like bullets.
I know, really I know.
More silence. But before Lauren drove back to Appledore, they'd been crying together, and Eve had found comfort in the fact that there was someone to share her grief. By the time Lauren left, all the police officers had drifted away and Eve had retreated upstairs. So much had happened in less than a week that her brain seemed overloaded, heavy. It was a physical sensation. She could feel the weight of her head on her shoulders, down her back and through to her feet. How could she carry so much without collapsing? She sat by the window and watched the sky become darker, richer, until it turned black. Despite the tiredness, she knew she wouldn't sleep, and still she remained in the chair she'd picked up in a charity shop in Biddeford, thinking of the people involved in her father's life and her life, the living and the dead, and what could have strung them all together and brought them to this. Her window faced east, away from the sea, and she was still sitting there at the first grey light of dawn. She might have dozed a little, but her mind hadn't stopped racing. Snippets of remembered conversations were threaded to images, faces, places, a giant necklace of memories. And then she thought she knew. It started as a suspicion as faint and insubstantial as the pearly light she could see from the window. A memory of the early morning before she'd found her father. Another approaching dawn. A sound filtered through sleep, forgotten in the shock of discovering his body. She got up and made tea, because tea was real and prosaic, and her ideas were fanciful. She needed to stay grounded. Through her window came the dawn chorus, at first a few stray notes, then the full choir of birdsong, impossibly loud. The noise sounded like a validation of her theories. Now Eve wondered what she should do next. She couldn't imagine talking to Matthew Venn with his polished shoes and his perfectly ironed shirts. He'd expect facts and logic. She wasn't even sure that Jen Rafferty, who was much more on her wavelength, would understand. Besides, how could she accuse someone of murder with no evidence at all after a strange wakeful night of dreams and fantasies? It could ruin a life. It occurred to her that Lauren Miller would listen to her theories and would help her sort through them. She had a logical mind and a clear vision, but Eve was still confused about her relationship with the woman. To confide these midnight ramblings would imply an intimacy that Eve wasn't quite ready for. Then she thought of Jonathan Church. He was married to the police inspector, and he was a friend, a real friend. She remembered him bringing her back to the flat the evening that Wesley had been killed, sitting on the floor and drinking wine with her. That was what she needed, someone she could confide in who wasn't official, who wouldn't see every word as a formal statement. She'd make another cup of tea and then she'd text him, ask if it was okay for her to call into the woodyard for a chat. The idea of sitting in his office with the bustle of the art center going on all around them, of the man himself, solid and square in his cotton t-shirt and his baggy khaki shorts, was reassuring. Jonathan had always reminded her a little of her father. It was his ability to listen, to take her anxieties seriously, but somehow to take them onto his own shoulders, to share them. She made the tea and got out her phone. Jonathan must be up early too, because he replied soon after. Of course. Busy all day, but what about coming over to the woodyard for an early supper? 5:30? She wished she'd been able to see him earlier and felt a moment of impatience. Perhaps she should talk to somebody else. Then she thought that there wasn't really any rush. She'd probably got the thing all wrong anyway, losing perspective after her sleepless night. It would be good to spend some time in the studio making glass. In the meantime, there might be a way to check if her nighttime imaginings had any truth in them at all, to prove to herself and to others that she was still quite sane. Chapter 39. Matthew and Jonathan ate breakfast together. Jonathan had already been outside for his daily swim. He'd come back exhilarated, his hair still wet, his sandy feet leaving marks on the kitchen floor. He squeezed fresh orange juice and made coffee, and by then Matthew was up too, amazed that his partner could have so much energy. How's it all going? Jonathan hadn't asked the evening before, and Matthew had been grateful for that. When he'd arrived home exhausted, he had preferred to hear Jonathan chat about normal things, an art exhibition at the Woodyard, the touring theatre company bringing a new play, Morris Braddock's adaptation to Life Without Lucy, Bob's new menu in the centre cafe. It's muddled, Matthew said now, drinking the last of the coffee. Too much going on, too many connections, too many motives. He paused. After the early briefing, I'm meeting Lay's lawyer. That might throw a bit of light. Eve texted. Jonathan was spreading homemade marmalade on thick brown toast. I'm meeting her for supper tonight in the woodyard. What does she want? I guess a bit of support and a shoulder to cry on. She's lost three people very close to her. Jonathan paused. And even that'll be light relief after the trustees' finance meeting, which is happening for most of the rest of the day. Matthew smiled. The arts centre thrived under Jonathan's care, but figures seemed too abstract a concept for him to grasp. Lay's solicitor had an office in Barnstable, in an elegant terrace looking out over the River Tor. With its long windows and decorative shutters, it wouldn't have looked out of place in a provincial French town. Matthew had walked from the briefing through the town centre and along the riverbank. Above the tide line, the mud had been baked hard and edged white with dried salt. The solicitor was waiting for him in reception. He had the easy manner of an old-fashioned country doctor, confident and competent. We don't open to the public until 9:30, so there's nobody in to man the front desk. Come along to my office. It was upstairs at the front of the building, one of the rooms with the shutters. The long window was open, letting in a little air and the sound of traffic below and exhaust fumes. Peter Mason, the solicitor, closed it and half pulled together the slatted shutters so the light was filtered through the bars. Poor Frank, he said. He was more than a client, he was a friend. I'll miss him. Mason looked up. You said on the telephone that it was suicide. Yes, we're waiting for the post-mortem results, but we think it was an overdose of antidepressants. He'd been prescribed them during a previous bout of illness. Does that surprise you? It does, rather. I think he might have considered suicide rather an indulgence. You'd known him for a long time. Since we were 11. We were in school together. He paused. He was an odd little scrap even then. In what way? He was fascinated by figures, patterns, money, not for what it could buy, but for the way the market worked. He was the only teenager I've ever met who read the Financial Times. He didn't go to university. He was bright enough, but couldn't see the point. Joined a city trader and worked his way up. I was more conventional and didn't stray so far from home. I went off to Exeter to read law. Matthew decided to let him continue without interruption. He found the story of Lay's youth fascinating. There was a gap in the conversation while Mason collected his thoughts, and Matthew heard the gulls on the river against the background rumble of traffic below. He was an only child, of course, Mason said, and Westercombe seemed a bit old-fashioned even then. The family scraped a living from the land. He was very much a loner. Now, I think you might say Francis was somewhere on the autistic spectrum. He found social contact a bit tricky. He was happier with his numbers, and couldn't understand people who were less logical, more emotional in their response to the world around them. I was really his only friend at school, but he didn't care. Matthew thought about that. It made sense, and perhaps it explained Lay's decision to close the mount. It was rational, inevitable, and he hadn't quite seen how it would have a personal impact on the residents. You kept in touch as adults? We weren't close when he was working in London, but we'd meet up when I was back during university holidays, and he was home to visit his mother. Mason smiled. Perhaps we were both misfits. I was a bit of a geek, too. We shared a love of cricket, so we had that in common. Then, when we both moved back to North Devon, and he asked me to look after his legal affairs, we saw more of each other. Did he ever have a partner? There were women that he fancied, lusted after at a distance, but he didn't have the confidence or the skills to approach them, to get close to them. I'm not sure that he ever had a proper relationship. Mason paused. There was one woman he'd worked with. She was married to someone else, but recently the marriage broke up, and she turned up here in North Devon. I think Frank hoped something might come of it. Matthew felt a fresh stab of sympathy for Frank. How galling it must have been. He'd worshipped Lauren from afar for years, invited her for a meal in his home, and she'd fallen for Nigel Yeo, one of his other guests. And then, when Frank had shared his true feelings, she'd rejected him. Had you seen Mr. Lay recently? We met up for dinner about a month ago. Mason paused. It was a regular arrangement. Frank was a very generous man. He always took me to his favourite restaurant. It was a treat, and I looked forward to it. How did he seem? His usual self? Not particularly low or depressed? The solicitor shrugged. No, I don't think so. Had Mr. Lay made a will? He had. Mason went to a filing cabinet and pulled out a manila envelope. I'm his executor as well as his lawyer. If he hadn't made the will, Matthew said, everything would be left to his next of kin. Yes, a woman called Sarah Grieve, who was the granddaughter of his mother's sister. There was no other close living relative. Mason pulled the will from the envelope. Would you like me to explain the major points, then I can give you a copy to take away? Please. You have to know, Inspector, that while Frank was still a wealthy man, he'd been a philanthropist since making his fortune, and much of his money had already been given away. However, of course, he still did have considerable assets. Now, Matthew was tempted to hurry him along, but after all, Mason had already given useful information, and he might still have more to pass on. Best to let him give the details in his own way and at his own speed. Westercombe Farm, the house and all its land, was bequeathed to Sarah Grieve, and, in the event of her death, to her heirs. Ah, Matthew said. He thought the Greaves should be pleased, relieved. Francis had told them that he didn't believe in inherited wealth, and they were anxious about their future. There is a stipulation, Mason went on. The land should not be sold for commercial development, and the family should live in the house and continue to farm traditionally. He looked up from the desk. He'd grown up there and had been very fond of his mother who died there. He had an uncharacteristically emotional attachment to the place and was concerned that its character shouldn't change. Matthew wondered what John Grieve would make of that. The man had clearly wanted a fresh start away from Westercombe, but perhaps being allowed to farm independently without an on-site landlord would be enough for him. Mason was continuing. The freehold of the studios and workshops created from farmyard outbuildings have been left to Wesley Curnow and Eve Yeo respectively, along with £20,000 each to support their businesses. He looked up. Of course, that's no longer relevant now that Mr. Curnow's dead, and that workshop will revert to the rest of the farm estate. Is there any specific mention of the Spennacott project, and the properties Francis owned there? Matthew remembered his visit to the old folks' home, and wondered if there would be any reprieve for the residents.
Indeed, yes, that's one of the more complex and unorthodox stipulations, added relatively recently. Frank left the cottages, public house, shop, and the Mount, currently in operation as a care home for the elderly, to a community trust of villagers and stakeholders yet to be formed. Mason gave a grimace. My firm was charged with setting that up. I must say I'd rather hope that Frank would outlive me, or that I would have retired before that became necessary. I'm not looking forward to the inevitable endless wrangles and the committee meetings running into the night.
Matthew smiled in sympathy. And the rest of his investments and savings?
$250,000 to the Spennacott Trust, seed money to see it through its setup. After that, it will be expected to live off the rents and profits of the various businesses. Any excess to be invested for the good of the village.
I suppose that makes sense.
Another $250,000 goes to the organization Patients Together.
Mason looked at the paper on the desk in front of him and read the exact words.
To allow this valuable organization to continue to hold the North Devon Health Trust to account.
So, another of the inheritors is no longer alive to benefit, Ven said. Nigel Yeo, who ran it, was our first victim. He wondered what Roger Pryor would have made of the bequest and the wording.
Oh, that sum didn't go to any individual, but to the organization. The money will still go to Patients Together.
Had he told any of the beneficiaries that they were mentioned in his will? Ven remembered his last conversation with Lauren. She had told him that she was considering applying to run the NDPT. He wondered if the information that she wouldn't have to scratch around for funding, at least in the short term, could have influenced her decision. He thought it unlikely.
That I don't know.
Were you involved in Mr. Lay's investment in a family business in Instow, the Sandpiper, owned by the Mackenzie family?
Not personally, Mason said. Not my area of expertise, but one of my partners drew up the contract.
As I understand it, the money was an interest-free loan rather than a formal investment, and it has already been repaid. Can you confirm that?
I'd need to check with my colleague, but it's the sort of arrangement Frank might have made.
Very generous.
As I said before, Inspector,
Frank was a very generous man.
Mason put the will back into its envelope. The remainder of his wealth will go to a number of national and international charities, but I don't think there's anything else relating to your inquiries.
When will you inform the people who'll benefit from Mr. Lay's will of their good fortune?
Letters will go out today to the individuals and organizations involved. Of course, probate will take a while and they won't receive the money for some time, but it's important that the Greaves continue to manage Westercombe, and they're more likely to do that if they know they have a stake in the place.
Ven nodded and got to his feet. Mason walked down the stairs with him to show him out, and shook his hand at the door. Outside, the air felt a little different. The sky was still clear, but it was humid and sultry, as if soon the heat wave would break, as if they were on the brink of a thunderstorm.
Chapter 40. Jen stayed at home long enough to have breakfast with the kids. Since Nigel Yeo's murder, they'd all been working ridiculous hours, and no way would the overtime budget stretch to cover it all. She was due a bit of time off, and it felt as if she'd hardly seen them for days. Ella was up, showered and dressed without any prompting, but Ben was still in bed when Jen had everything on the table. She knocked at the door of his room and went in. It was a small room, always dark. He never drew the curtains. It smelled of teenage boy, unwashed sheets and stale pizza. On the desk next to the bed, his computer seemed more alive than her son. Something was flashing. He'd probably been on it for most of the night, some game with his friends, killing people for fun, or checking out unsavory chat rooms. She was tempted to look, but he woke, looked at her, grunted. You'll be late for school. She couldn't bring herself to be cross. He looked very young, half asleep. Breakfast is on the table.
When they were both on their way to school, Jen made herself more coffee, then followed Matthew's suggestion and arranged to meet Lucy Braddock in her new flat in Riverbank, a small complex of apartments for learning disabled adults. She phoned Lucy's dad, Morris, to find out when would be a good time to visit.
Well, really, he said, you should be phoning our Luce. The social workers say that I should be letting her make those sort of decisions. She should be speaking for herself.
His voice was slow, his accent as rich and broad as his daughter's. I don't have her phone number, though. Jen left a pause. I was hoping you might be there, Morris. She'll be a bit more confident with you around, and I don't always understand her speech so well.
She's not on shift at the woodyard until this afternoon, Morris replied. I suppose I could phone her and ask her to stay in this morning, warn her that we'll be calling by.
Jen could tell that he was delighted to have an excuse to visit his daughter.
I was planning to come into Barnstable to do a bit of shopping anyway.
While she was waiting until it was time to visit Lucy, Jen pulled together images of the women Wesley Curnow had known. She was reminded of the Simon Walden investigation, another occasion when she'd shown photographs to a woman with Down syndrome. But then Lucy had been a potential victim, not a witness. Jen found pictures of Martha and Janie McKenzie. They'd appeared in the local newspaper at the time of Mac's death. Both women were wearing black and looked gaunt. Even Martha was looking away from the camera, not playing up to the crowd. George was there too, and the article used his words as he'd railed against the system that had let his son down. Cynthia was easy to find. Jen chose an image of her friend wearing a vivid red and pink silk dress. She looked at it for a moment and experienced something akin to grief, because the friendship they shared was slipping away. It felt like a kind of bereavement. Lucy lived in a three-story block of new flats built on land which had once been owned by the timber factory. The building itself had been transformed into the woodyard centre, but the land had been released for development and the independent living apartments were part of the site. They stood next to a small estate of family social housing and looked out over a children's playground. Jen used the woodyard car park and walked past the centre to reach Lucy's place. Just as she was passing the woodyard entrance, she saw Cynthia approaching from inside. She was carrying a rolled-up yoga mat. It would be impossible to avoid bumping into her.
How's it going?
Jen thought no fucking way was Lady Cynth just going to march past with her nose in the air as if they didn't know each other, as if they hadn't once been best mates. Cynthia stopped and shrugged.
Pretty dreadful.
It sounded like an admission of failure. This wasn't the old Cynthia of high energy and endless optimism.
Roger hardly speaks. He's working 12-hour days, and when he's home, he locks himself in the office. He seems to be awake most of the night.
She looked straight at Jen.
I'm worried about him. Even when things were really bad in London, he wasn't this low.
You think he's depressed? I mean, clinically depressed?
Yeah, I do.
Cynthia was on the verge of tears.
I've said he should go to a doctor, but he tells me to leave him alone. There's this anger. I mean, if he was just sitting in a corner weeping, I could handle it, but there's a terrible rage against the world and me. For some reason, he blames me for all that's happening to him.
A pause.
We were never soulmates, you know. We never lived in each other's pockets. But in a way, that was why it worked. We were so different that we learned from each other. There was something new to discuss when we did come together. But now, I feel as if I've lost him.
Jen thought this was one of the unconsidered effects of two murders. Stress and suspicion were causing individuals, relationships, and even communities to fall apart. She looked at her watch. She should be chatting to Lucy.
Will you be around all morning? I'll call in, shall I? You can make me one of your spectacular coffees.
A moment of silence. Jen thought that if the offer was rejected, the friendship would be over for good. No way back. But Cynthia smiled.
Yeah, she said. I'd really like that.
Morris was already in the flat when Jen got there, but it was Lucy who let Jen in, proud as punch. She held her arms wide.
Welcome!
The place gave out the vibe of a student hall of residence, but Lucy had her own living space, a sitting room with a kitchen at one end, as well as the bedroom and a shower room. She insisted on showing Jen around before putting the kettle on and carefully spooning instant coffee into three mugs.
There's a care worker on site, Morris said. But Luce manages everything, don't you, maid?
Yep.
She beamed. We need your help again, Jen said. But there's no danger this time, honest. The last statement was aimed at Morris, not Lucy. I just need you to look at a few pictures. Let me know if you saw any of these women on Sunday after Wesley had been in the cafe. If you finished work soon after, you might have noticed someone while you were walking home.
Sure,
Lucy said. Jen thought she was proud to be asked and desperate to help. She worried that Lucy would try too hard, would convince herself that she recognized one of the faces just to please. It's not a test, Luce. It's just as important you tell me if you don't see anyone you know. Just as useful. Lucy nodded. But in the end, when Lucy just stared blankly at the pictures, even at someone like Cynthia, who was a regular in the cafe, they all had a sense of disappointment.
I just don't remember seeing anyone, she said. When I left work, a bus came into the stop in front of the woodyard and people got off. I knew two of my friends from Riverbank had gone to Biddeford to see their families, and I was looking out for them. They'd texted to say they were on their way home. I thought I could walk back to the flat with them. I saw them get off the bus and I waited for them to join me. There was a car coming in and for a minute they couldn't see me, even though I was waving. The car blocked their view.
She paused for a moment.
That's a bit weird, isn't it? Because the centre was closing. So why would anyone come in?
What sort of car, Lucy? Jen tried to keep any sense of urgency from her voice.
I don't know anything about cars.
Now she was starting to sound anxious and upset. Jen could tell that Morris was about to call a halt to the whole conversation. He fidgeted in his seat and wiped his forehead with a large white handkerchief.
Oh, nor do I.
Jen jumped in before he could speak.
Nothing at all. But you might remember a colour.
Yes, Lucy was triumphant.
It was black, a big black car.
I don't suppose you could tell if it was being driven by a man or a woman? Lucy shook her head.
I didn't see. I was looking out for my mates getting off the bus, and then we were chatting.
Jen left Morris and Lucy sitting together and drinking more coffee. She was thinking that the father needed the company far more than the daughter did. Jen went through the garden gate and round to the back of Cynthia's house so she didn't have to go into the house past Roger's office. Even if Cynthia wasn't outside, she'd be in the kitchen, and Jen could knock on the back door. In the end, Cynthia was in the garden, in the chair where they'd had their last conversation. There was a bottle of Pinot Gris in an ice bucket, and she'd already poured herself a glass. No chance of a fancy coffee then.
You're starting a bit early.
Jen took a seat beside her. She thought this was like being in an entirely different country or continent, the rainforest or some Maharaja's garden in India. She'd never been to either, but despite the drought, there was something exotic about the bright colours and the lush vegetation.
It's lunchtime, Cynthia said. It's civilised to have a small glass with lunch.
On the table, there was a tray of cheese and cold meat, salad, French bread, a bowl of grapes and strawberries. Two plates, two knives, and another glass.
Will you join me?
Are you joking?
Of course. I'm starving.
Cynthia pushed across a plate and a knife, then poured Jen a glass of wine. She seemed more composed than when she'd bumped into Jen outside the woodyard, more in control. She'd prepared herself for the encounter.
I shouldn't have the wine. You know the boss, a stickler.
But Jen took a sip all the same. This was more important than Ben's rules.
What do you think's going on with Roger?
She pulled a piece of bread from the loaf and cut a slice of oozing brie, gave all her attention to the taste. Re-establishing a friendship was important, of course, but so was eating when you were given a chance in the middle of an investigation.
Well, I don't think he killed Nigel Yeo and the others.
Cynthia was prickly again. The tension made her voice shrill.
I'm here as a mate, Jen said. Not a cop. You're always a cop.
There was no real answer to that, and it was Cynthia who spoke next.
He's so stressed. I'm worried about what he might do. I know he would never harm other people. He's given his life to the NHS, to saving lives. He might not be a medic, but he's supported them, fought for them, battled with the government for more resources, more staff. It was that passion that made me fall for him.
Do you think he might be so depressed that he'd consider taking his own life? Is that what you're saying?
There was a moment of silence broken by the raucous call of a magpie.
Yes, Cynthia said. You know, really, I think that he might. Do you know what he's doing when he's spending all that time in the house in his office?
What do you mean? Cynthia had drunk her wine. She poured herself another glass.
We've been investigating Mac McKenzie's browsing history. He was a member of a chat room called Peace at Last. It's a support group for people considering suicide. Within that, there's a core group who call themselves the Suicide Club. That seems to be made up of more desperate members. We're worried that one or more of those people are actively encouraging or provoking people to kill themselves.
You think Roger might be a member?
Now soundless tears were running down Cynthia's face.
That he could be considering suicide.
I'm worried that it might be possible. He was in touch with the professionals treating Luke Wallace, as well as those looking after Mac. We know that both young men were members of the group.
And they both killed themselves.
Yes, they both killed themselves. And Roger might have had access to enough information from the medics treating them to find the site.
Jen paused. It could have started off as professional interest, a way of proving that something other than healthcare negligence had contributed to the suicides.
I don't know what to do.
The tears were still streaming down Cynthia's face. She had turned from a confident, competent woman into a child desperate for reassurance, looking for someone to make decisions for her.
Do you have the passcode for his computer? We could get in and look.
And I could find out whether or not he calls himself the Crow.
No, Cynthia said. The office is his personal space. I never go in when he's not here.
Jen was forming an argument in her head.
If you're anxious about his safety, don't you think that's more important than intruding on his personal space?
But she didn't have time to speak, because the phone in her pocket buzzed. A text from Matthew Venn, asking her whereabouts and requesting that she come back to the station as soon as possible.
I've got to go, she said. Work. Sorry.
Cynthia stood up.
Of course. It always is work, isn't it? There's no escape for you.
The words sounded like an accusation. She was still crying. It was as if all the liquid in her body was leaking through her eyes, as if she might drown in it. Jen took the woman into her arms and squeezed her tight. For a moment, Cynthia relaxed enough to allow herself to be hugged.
See if you can keep Roger away from the office when he comes in tonight, Jen said. If he's found that website, I can see it could become a kind of obsession, an addiction. It's probably as compulsive, as exciting as it gets. Watching someone deciding if they're going to live or die. Then deciding yourself if it's your turn next.
Or if you can persuade them to take the final step.
Cynthia nodded, but Jen could tell she wouldn't stand up to her husband, and she wouldn't ask him about the website or his mood. The couple had got into the habit of leading separate lives, and had forgotten how to talk about anything important.
Chapter 41. Techie Steve had a flat above a florist's shop in a lane just off Boutport Street. The smell of the blooms soaking in the buckets outside hit Ross as he waited to be let in. Next door there was a rowdy pub, and even this early in the day there were a few people in the beer garden. Ross couldn't think why Steve was still living here. The noise late into the evening would have driven him crazy, especially in this weather when everyone wanted to be outside. Steve didn't seem to be bothered by it. Perhaps because the flat was long and thin and the rooms got darker and quieter the further in from the street it went. As Ross remembered, it was like moving to the back of a cave. At the top of the steps that led up from the nondescript door off the pavement, there was a kitchen littered with pizza boxes and foil containers from takeaway restaurants. Empty beer cans. A smell that would set alarm bells ringing with environmental health. This is where Steve was waiting after Ross had pressed the buzzer and climbed into the gloom. The cyber expert was wearing a filthy fleece dressing gown. Nothing else as far as Ross could tell. He stood, blinking.
Fuck, man, what do you want? This feels like the middle of the night.
It's mid-morning and this is urgent. Where have you got with tracing the Suicide Club members?
Something else came in,
Steve muttered, still half asleep. Something well paid. Well, this is a matter of life and death. Ross looked at him with something close to disgust. How could someone who was so bright and so minted live like this? And you promised you'd stay on it.
I was up all night on the other case.
Steve turned away.
That was urgent too. I need some sleep.
Get in the shower and put some clothes on. I've been told to stay with you until we have an answer. So if you want any kind of life, you'd better get one for me. A pause, and we'll pay your going rate for a quick turnaround. Ross wasn't sure how he'd be able to honour that promise, but it seemed to have the required effect. Steve disappeared down the corridor, and Ross heard the sound of the hot water boiler firing up for the shower. He couldn't bear waiting in the chaos all around him. It made his skin crawl, and he found a black bin bag, began to fill it with the fast food containers and banana peel. There was a small dishwasher, and he stacked that too. By the time Steve returned, dressed in jeans and a black polo shirt, the worktops had been wiped down. He seemed not to notice any change in the kitchen and didn't thank Ross for his efforts. He went to the fridge and took out a can of Coke, offered one to Ross, who, in the absence of tea or coffee, took it.
Okay then, let's get working.
Steve had always relished a challenge. His focus had shifted back to the suicide club and away from his other, possibly more lucrative project. He seemed almost pleased that Ross was there, pushing him to action. The corridor led past a living room. Ross had spent boys' evenings of beer and footy on the telly there on previous visits. It went on past a bathroom and a closed door, which must lead into Steve's bedroom. This was the furthest Ross had ever been in the flat, but Steve walked on and into a room right at the end of the corridor. Inside there was a dense darkness, no windows and no external sound. Ross thought someone could go in there and disappear forever. Steve probably did go in there and disappear for days. Steve switched on a lamp that provided a pool of light on a desk and shone on more tech than Ross had thought could possibly be contained in one room. Unlike the kitchen, it was clinically clean. There was no dust on the keyboards, no smears on the screens. There was only one chair, a grand leather affair, and Steve sat there, looking, Ross thought, like the captain of the Starship Enterprise. They shared an affection for clunky science fiction, and Ross suspected that the impression was deliberate. There was nowhere for him to sit, and he leaned against the wall. An officer for Patients Together got into the suicide club and discovered that the moderator had a username of the Crow, Ross said. What we really need is his real name and contact details. The woman couldn't get those for us.
Well, an amateur wouldn't know where to start.
A pause.
Surprised she got that far.
He turned to face Ross.
Look, I'm on it. Why don't you piss off and come back in a couple of hours? I can't concentrate with you looking over my shoulder.
Ross looked at his watch. It was already nearly lunchtime.
An hour.
Steve was focused on the screen and seemed not to hear.
Take a key. It's hanging on a hook in the kitchen. This is soundproofed and I won't hear you ringing.
Ross decided to go home for lunch. On impulse, he bought roses for Mel from the flower shop before leaving the street. They were pink, like the ones she'd had in her wedding bouquet. He wasn't given to romantic impulses, but he felt the need to express his feelings for her. He thought again that he'd taken her for granted recently. Perhaps that lay at the root of this strange intermittent tension between them. He didn't dig into the real fear, but she'd found someone else who was giving her more attention, who appreciated her more. When he got to the house, it seemed unnaturally quiet. He switched on local radio, put the flowers in a vase, and made himself a sandwich. That was when he saw that Mel had left her work diary at home. It sat on the worktop, tempting him. He knew he shouldn't look. But it was work, wasn't it? Not private. This wasn't him stalking or being controlling. He had gone on a course about coercive control before Christmas, and then a case earlier in the year had brought the reality home to him. Before that, he'd been inclined to dismiss the new law as an overreaction. He'd understood that physical abuse was evil and hated the pathetic men who beat up women. But weren't women who allowed themselves to be told what to wear and who to see to blame too? After being involved in the case where extreme coercive control had led to violence, to murder, he'd seen how wrong he'd been. All the same, this wasn't real controlling behaviour, was it? It was taking an interest. He stood staring at the diary. He was about to reach out and pick it up when the door opened and Mel came in. She looked flushed and flustered, surprised to see him.
I wasn't expecting you to be here.
I bought you flowers, he said.
Oh.
It wasn't the response he'd been expecting or hoping for. It was surprise, not pleasure, and there was a kind of guilt in there somewhere, as if she thought she didn't quite deserve the gesture. She must have realized that more was expected, because she smiled and touched his shoulder.
That's lovely, really lovely.
I've just made a sandwich. Can I get you one?
No,
she said. I'll grab something at work. I must have left my diary behind and I can't function without it. He wasn't sure if she'd seen him about to reach for it, feeling guilty that he'd even contemplated reading it. It's there on the bench. I just noticed it.
Oh, yeah.
She gave him a little peck on the lips and grabbed the book. At the door, she turned back.
Thanks for the roses, she said. They're beautiful.
A pause.
There's something I need to tell you.
What is it? He felt suddenly terrified. All that he'd known, taken for granted, seemed to be sliding away from him.
Nothing dreadful, she said. Honestly, I have to get back to work, but you will be in?
Yeah, he said, because he couldn't shout at her, could he? He couldn't force her to talk to him now.
See you tonight.
Yeah, see you then. She gave a little wave and hurried away. Her scent lingered for a moment in the room, and then that disappeared too. He let himself back into Steve's flat, glad to focus on work again. The kitchen was as he'd left it. He took a can of Coke from the fridge and carried it through to Steve's office. The man didn't seem to hear him come in. He was leaning forwards, his nose almost touching the screen, muttering to himself.
Stephen Barton, you can bloody do this.
Ross put the Coke on the desk in front of him.
Well?
He's clever. I've got details of the Suicide Club's membership, but not of the Crow himself. That'll take a bit longer.
Oh.
Ross was disappointed. He'd imagined himself standing in front of the room at the evening briefing, the killer already in custody, taking the glory. Steve looked briefly away from his screen.
Look, I'll get there. I'm on it.
And Ross saw that Steve was totally involved in getting a result now. This was a challenge, and there was nothing the man liked better. He wouldn't eat or sleep until he had identified the leader of the group.
You give me a ring as soon as you got it?
Yeah, sure.
His eyes still fixed on the screen, he slid a sheet of paper across the desk to Ross. I printed out the members' details for you. Ross looked at the list. There were 12 names there. He recognized one of them.
I've got to go.
Oh, all right.
Steve was lost in his digital world again. Pull the door to on your way out. Ross was the last of the group to arrive in the ops room. Even Vicky Robb was there before him, with a ballpoint in her hand ready to take notes. They all stared at him. They could tell that he had something important to share. Steve hasn't got the identity of the Crow yet. It was best to limit expectations. He should have it by the end of the day. But he did find the membership list for the Suicide Club, and one of the people involved in the case is there.
Who?
Ross paused for effect, then saw that Venn was irritated by the delay.
Frank Lay.
There was a moment of silence. So the words of his suicide letter weren't coincidental, Venn said. He must have been considering the act for some time if he was a member of the inner circle. A pause. Perhaps Mac passed on his contact details to the moderator. We know they were close.
Could Frank have been provoked by the Crow?
Jen asked. As we suspect, Mac was provoked? Perhaps. Venn seemed lost in thought. It was as if he had known the dead man well. Ross thought he should be more detached. Joe Oldham always said it was wrong to get too emotionally involved with a case, and Ross agreed. Jen stuck up her hand. I know it's a bit left field, but do you think John Grieve could be the Crow? He spends a lot of time on his computer and he seems very stressed, very low. He knew both suicide victims and could have lured them into the site.
A beat. He could be our killer.
Again, it took Venn a while to answer. These periods of silence made Ross uneasy. He felt himself get tense and fidgety, the bad boy at the back of the classroom again. I don't know Grieve well enough to tell. Go and talk to him, Jen. It could make sense if Mac killed himself because Grieve goaded him into it, and Nigel Yeo found out and threatened to tell Frank. The man would have a lot to lose. His
His home, his livelihood. It might be a factor in Lay's suicide, too, if the family is set to inherit. Greaves certainly has motive.
Sure. Jen pushed her red hair away from her face. I'll go now.
Ross was left with a faint sense of anticlimax. It was unfair that, yet again, he was being excluded from all the action. Chapter 42. Jen drove to Westercombe on her own. Matthew didn't want anyone to go with her in case they freaked out John Grieve or upset the man's family. He'd sent Ross in his own car to wait in the lane, though, just in case she needed support later. Jen thought that was Venn's style all over. Understated. No dramatics, not overreacting, but assessing the risk all the same. All the way there, she was planning scenarios. Would it be better to speak to Grieve on his own without Sarah present? She thought it probably would. If he was the crow, he'd be reluctant to admit it to his wife. He'd felt impotent at Westercombe, the subject of her relative's benevolence, unable to take his own decisions about the farm or the dairy. If he was the leading member of the suicide club, he might have believed he had the power over life and death, and that would have been heady, intoxicating. Sarah was in the front garden of the cottage, picking mint that had been planted in an old enameled sink when Jen drove in. A domestic scene which made her plans for the encounter with Grieve seem an overreaction, slightly ridiculous. Sarah called across to her as soon as Jen got out of the car.
Hiya, I was just about to put the kettle on if you fancy some tea.
I was hoping to chat to John if he's around.
He's upstairs in the office doing the accounts.
By this time, Jen had joined her and Sarah lowered her voice.
At least, that's what he says he's doing. How does he seem today?
Sarah shrugged.
Still pretty low. I've wanted to leave him alone. He was on his own when I took the kids to school, but apart from that, I've been around. I even went with him to bring the cows up for milking. I said I fancied the fresh air and the exercise.
She was speaking very quietly, though there was nobody around to hear.
Come on in. I'll call John down.
Where are the girls?
It's one of their friends' birthdays. They've all gone to the leisure centre in Barnstable for swimming and tea.
One piece of luck. Sarah switched on the kettle, then stood at the bottom of the stairs and shouted up to her husband. There was no reply.
I'll go up to him, Jen said. You should be putting your feet up this stage of pregnancy. Make the most of having the girls out of the way and enjoy some tea and peace.
She was halfway up the stairs already and pretended not to hear Sarah shouting after her that this really wasn't a good idea. John was in the little room that they'd already started decorating as a nursery. He was sitting at an IKEA desk with headphones on. As Jen had imagined, there was a mobile hanging from the ceiling close to his left ear, penguins with bright red beaks, a polar bear. He didn't hear when Jen tapped at the door and only noticed her when she was right inside the room and standing beside him. There was nowhere else for her to sit, so she perched on the edge of the desk. He reached out to shut down the computer, but she took hold of his arm before he could touch the keyboard and gestured for him to take off the headphones.
Who are you encouraging to kill themselves today?
The words were fierce, but her tone was calm, curious, even friendly. He stared at her.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The surprise seemed entirely genuine. She sat on an easy chair and for a second imagined Sarah sitting here, nursing her new baby in the early hours of the morning.
Have you ever felt like killing yourself, John? There are people who could help if you have.
He stared at her as if she were crazy.
No, I couldn't. I have responsibilities.
Something in his voice made her uncertain, though, and she waited for him to continue. Besides, haven't we all felt like that at one time or another?
What are you doing up here on the computer all the time?
He put his head in his hands and she saw he was shaking. He looked up straight at her.
I play, he said.
What? Computer games? Trying to keep the judgment out of her voice. Maybe he was one of those grown men who play computer games. He didn't answer.
What then?
Still no answer.
Perhaps we should continue this conversation at the police station.
I gamble.
The words came out as a scream.
When I'm up here, I'm betting online. I know it's a problem. I keep meaning to stop, but then I'm sucked back. Bigger prizes, free bets, and I've lost so much.
How can I tell Sarah when she works so hard?
She hasn't guessed.
He shook his head.
She's always left the financial side of the business to me. She always said I was good with money.
There was a silence. He looked out at the garden, at the swing hanging from the tree where his daughters loved playing. For a brief moment, Jen imagined Grieve hanging there too, his body limp. She wondered if, despite his earlier denial, he'd ever contemplated it.
It crept up on me.
Grieve's voice was whining, grating.
It started as a bit of fun, an adrenaline rush after a boring day. It's an addiction, an illness. You don't understand.
No, Jen said. I don't. His self-pity was making her angry now. She knew she should contain it, but she wanted to shake him.
You've got a lovely wife and two kids. Another on the way. You don't understand,
Grieve said again.
That was how it started, thinking I might make enough to give them the sort of life they deserve.
You need to get professional help. She was seriously losing patience. More than losing patience, it was the man's apathy and self-delusion that got under her skin. She imagined slapping him to bring him somehow to his senses and found herself enjoying the image. She nodded to the computer screen.
Getting caught up in that nonsense is just pathetic.
She thought he was going to lash out then, but he gripped the sides of the desk until his knuckles were white and he said nothing.
Did Nigel Yeo find out about the gambling and threaten to tell your wife?
No.
Again, the man just seemed confused.
What would it have to do with him?
If John Grieve was lying, Jen thought, he was good. He might be a gambler, losing money he couldn't afford, deceiving his wife about his obsession, but she didn't see him as a murderer. She couldn't imagine him sticking a weapon into a person's neck and watching the blood spilling out, and then doing it all over again. He was too weak. He might lash out in a rage, but could he organize all the details around Wesley's murder? Could he have been sufficiently ruthless to lure Curno to the woodyard and then send the text to Eve? It seemed unlikely.
John?
It was Sarah calling from the bottom of the stairs.
John, what's going on?
Sarah Grieve was just where Jen had left her. There was anxiety in the tension of her body, the face, which was pale despite weeks of sunshine, the protective stance. Her relationship to Grieve was almost maternal. There'd been no attempt to follow Jen's suggestion to put up her feet and rest with some tea. Now, Jen might not have been there.
What's happening?
The question directed at her husband. Are you going to tell her, or am I? Jen knew it wasn't her place to interfere, but she hated to see this family falling apart.
Is it about these murders?
Sarah's voice was squeaky with stress.
No!
He was yelling.
What sort of man do you both think I am?
Neither woman answered. I'm going outside, Jen said. I need to speak to a colleague. I'll be back in a couple of minutes. Give you two a chance to talk. She stood outside the fairy-story thatched cottage, with its clematis on the wall and the swing hanging from the tree, and phoned Ross. Grieve's not the crow. He's been holed up in his office gambling online, not provoking poor depressed souls to kill themselves. You might as well go back to the station. She expected him to say something scathing about her having jumped to conclusions during the briefing, but he was almost sympathetic.
No worries, you had to check it out.
Back in the cottage, Sarah and John were sitting at the kitchen table. Tension fizzed between them. Jen joined them.
Do you need to pick up the girls?
Sarah shook her head.
They're getting a lift back.
Grand. One less thing to worry about. The question, domestic and ordinary, seemed to relax the situation a little. Sarah looked up at her, glad to be distracted.
Have you got kids?
Jen nodded.
Two.
It was a nightmare when they were younger. I felt like a taxi service. A beat. Has John told you about his problem? The woman nodded.
Some problem? Thousands of pounds in debt. When I've been working every hour there is.
I don't think he's very well. The two women might have been alone in the room.
I didn't know what he was doing up there. All those hours on the computer.
The words flashed back. Sarah was flushed.
I thought it was porn, okay? I'm not up for sex much these days, not with this weight and this heat, so I thought just let him get on with it. Don't ask, enjoy the peace. She pushed her hair away from her forehead. I thought he was just being moody and I let it go. I had enough on my plate with the dairy and the kids and looking after Frank's house. I thought we were going through a tough time and everything would be back to normal once the baby was born. But it won't, will it? Things will never go back to normal again.
On the other side of the table, John Grieve sat in silence, his head in his hands. It was as if he was trying to make himself invisible and the conversation was going on without him.
Really, Jen said, there's no reason why not. Now you know and John can get help.
She paused.
Frank had made a will. He left all this, the house and the farm, to you. But you won't be able to sell it for development. You'll have to farm it traditionally, as you have been doing.
There was another longer silence as Sarah seemed to be assimilating the news. She looked at her husband, then back at Jen.
So, the cottage and the farm will be ours?
And the big house, as long as you meet those conditions. Eve would still keep her workshop in the flat.
You're joking. We'd have all that space.
She seemed astounded.
John, do you see what this means?
He lifted his head. Jen wondered if he was thinking he'd never escape from Westercombe now. He'd never have that farm on the edge of the moor he'd been dreaming of, gambling on.
It'd be a whole fresh start, Sarah said.
Maybe. Jen didn't think it would be that easy. She'd never quite believed in simple, happy endings.
You really didn't know what Frank was intending?
Sarah shook her head.
No idea at all. Frank was always ranting about inherited wealth, worthless people who had power just because their parents had made a fortune.
Perhaps he didn't think you were worthless, Jen said. Perhaps he thought you both deserved it.
God, she thought, that sounds like one of those quotes that my soppy friends spread around on Facebook, along with the images of their perfect families, the ones that make me want to throw up.
Sarah, though, seemed to buy into the idea and to take the words seriously. She was probably the sort to share deep and meaningful words of calm and meditation all over her social media.
It's horrible that Frank killed himself. Of course it is. But it's like he's giving us a second chance.
She got up from her seat, walked behind her husband, and put her arms around his shoulders.
We can get through this. Together. Can't we?
John stood up too and held his wife close to him, but he still didn't answer. Walking across the yard to her car in the rosy evening light, Jen thought the air seemed heavy. It felt hard to breathe. She re-ran the conversation with John Grieve in her head. Her response to him had been unprofessional and out of proportion. He was clearly addicted to gambling. Police officers had been trained to be sympathetic, controlled, and he'd got under her skin. She'd almost lost it. The memory of the interview triggered another idea, a possible explanation for Nigel Yeo's murder, which was so unlikely that she wasn't sure she could share it yet with Matthew. She'd reached her vehicle and was wondering if she should do some private investigations of her own when the phone rang. Matthew Venn could read minds, it seemed, even at a distance.
Where are you?
Just walking back to the car. Did Ross tell you? John Grieve was spending all those hours on his computer because he was betting online. His wife had no idea. That was why he seemed so secretive and ashamed.
Yes. Did you believe his story?
Absolutely. He was shit scared of telling Sarah about it. We can get someone to look at his browsing history, though.
Could you go back and check something out for me?
I suppose so.
Jen knew she didn't sound enthusiastic, but she thought she'd escaped the farm and its inhabitants for one day.
Could you go to Eve Yeo's flat and her studio? It seems that she's gone missing.
Chapter 43. Jonathan was in his office, focused on spreadsheets and the minutes from the last trustees meeting, and didn't realise that Eve was late until an extra half hour had passed. It wasn't like her not to be on time. Once she'd described her punctuality as a curse, something she'd inherited from her father.
Mum always kept us waiting. It drove Dad crazy.
He'd had his phone on silent and checked it for missed calls and messages.
Nothing. He called her mobile and heard it go straight to voicemail. Leaving his office, he wandered downstairs to look for Eve there. She could be waiting in the lobby or in the cafe. The place was satisfyingly full. That evening, there would be a production in the Woodyard Small Theatre, and the audience was already arriving, catching up with friends in the bar, having an early supper. He looked into the cafe, but there was no sign of her, at the table he'd reserved for them, or chatting to Bob. Jonathan went to the counter and called in to the manager.
"Have you seen Eve Yo?"
Bob was so busy that he barely looked up.
"Nah, sorry, but you can see what it's like."
"Is Lucy around?" Lucy would recognise Eve.
"Her shift finished at 5. She'll be back later, just before the play starts."
That was when Jonathan had a real sense of unease, so he called Eve again and left her a message.
"Hey, love, where are you? Can you give me a ring?"
And that was when he went back to his office to call Matthew. After the call, he sat for a moment staring at the blank computer screen, but he knew that it would be impossible to concentrate on work. He'd asked Matthew if he should go to Westercombe to check on Eve.
"No need," Matthew had said. "Jen's already there. I'll get her to look."
So Jonathan was left, helpless and restless, with nothing useful to do. He locked his office and went back to the lobby. Lucy Braddock was just walking in, dressed in a bright green dress, swinging a big straw bag.
"Hi, Luce, you back to help with the play?"
She nodded.
"I just went home for my tea."
"I'm looking for Eve Yo. I don't suppose you've seen her."
"Eve, who makes the glass?"
"That's right."
"She was here earlier."
Lucy gave one of her delightful smiles.
"She was waiting for you."
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure."
Lucy sounded offended.
"Was Eve on her own when you saw her?"
"Yeah, she was just coming out of the ladies' loos."
"And what time was that? It's really quite important, Luce."
"It was 5 o'clock. Lucy was definite.
"I was just on my way home."
Back in his office, pacing now, not able to sit, Jonathan was on the phone again to Matthew.
"Is Lucy certain?"
Matthew paused. "You know what Oldham will say if we shift the whole focus of the investigation to the Woodyard on the evidence of a learning disabled adult, and Eve's car is still at Westercombe."
"Well, she wouldn't be driving if she was going to meet me for supper."
Despite his anxiety, Jonathan allowed a trace of amusement into his voice.
"We always shared a bottle of wine when we met up. I'd already booked a taxi to get me home. And yeah, Lucy was positive."
"Was Eve with anyone when Lucy saw her?" Jonathan thought he could sense Matthew holding his breath, waiting for an answer.
"No, Luce saw her outside the ladies' loos, so even if she'd come to the centre with someone else, she'd be on her own in there."
Jonathan paused.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Start a search of the place. We'll be there."